church in the world. This quarter we are going to study the relationship that the Church of Jesus Christ, established while he was here on earth, has to do with the world. We therefore will need to get a clear definition of what is meant by the church and what is meant by the world. Let's start with the world. The world has several meanings in the scriptures. It means this planet with plants and animals, water, lakes, rivers, mountains, everything to do with the world at large. The world that then was being overflowed by water perished. It also refers to people. We talk about worldly people. And when we use this word worldly, we are setting these people in contradistinction with heavenly-minded people. There's the world out there and the church in here. There's Jesus Christ and his followers, and there are worldly people. Ye do mind worldly things or earthly things? If I have told you worldly things or earthly things, you don't understand what you're going to do when I discuss with you heavenly things. So you think of the world as a group of persons in rebellion against God and Jesus Christ and the principles of the kingdom of heaven. There is going to be a new heavens and a new earth, or a new world. All things are going to pass away, all things are going to become new. So as we think of the world in this sense, we must set the idea against the idea of the church. Now, the church consists of God's people. They are the called out ones, the ecclesia, who form a circle, a cirque of fellowship and worship for mutual aid and corporate adoration of God. They have heard the call of God. They have responded to the call of God. They have organized themselves into various communities of believers. The church may be visible, it may not be visible. The church of Jesus consists of faithful ones who are doing the purposes of God. Now, as we think of this group of people, their identity is known really only to God. We cannot tell which is the wheat or the tares. We just take the visible church, the corporate body of believers, and we say, this constitutes the church. But in God's mind, it may or it may not constitute the church. And so theologians have spoken about the invisible church. And since it's a theory unknown to men, we leave it there and think about the true believers and identify in our thinking the true believers, the invisible church, with the church. We hope that all Seventh-day Adventists who form the church in these latter days are among the true believers of God. A biblical view of the world. How does God view the world? Well, in our key text, we think of the world as being the object of God's regard. God so loved the world that in giving Jesus Christ, he gave everything, that whosoever believeth should not perish. God therefore looks at the world as fallen, as condemned to perish, as ready to die. But his affection for these people that constitute the world, who are ready to die, solicits from his heart such a rich gift that he makes it possible that all those who might be about to perish need not perish, but have everlasting life. So the biblical view of the world is of a group of people and a planet doomed to extinction, but evoking in God's mind such a reaction that he moves heaven and gives his richest gifts in order to redeem that which was lost. Part number one. The world was made by God. As soon as we have said this, we have set in motion a great number of complicated thoughts. God designed this world. He designed all the systems of this world, the physical, the chemical, the geological, all the systems that go up to make this planet, the air and the sea and the currents and the convections, and he set in motion every system in this planet for the benefit of creatures that he was about to create. He made the world perfect. Then he peopled the world with fish, insects, reptiles, birds, animals, and finally, man. In some kind, in our artificial, arbitrary, arrogant relation to God's creation, that man was the highest. And he's called by inspiration the crowning work of creation. He made man akin to his creator to be able to plan and do and devise. God made this world perfect. He made it perfect for man. And he designed that man should reveal the Godhead. That was his purpose. To reveal the ideals of the Father, of whom he was made the Son. This was the divine purpose. He made it by his word, by his supreme power. He made it as an object of glory to his name, that through the things that he had made, all the systems, all the living created beings, the invisible power and Godhead might be manifest to the universe. Part number two. The inanimate part of the world is owned by God. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof. All the mineral resources, all the various ecosystems, all the creatures that he has made, the mountains, the power of the sun, light, air, every advantage, every resource that God has created, he owns. And he loaned all these inanimate things to man whom he had created. Man was to be the husbandman of all these resources. The earth was going to bring forth abundantly, bring forth from below its surface, from its surface, from above its surface, fruit of every kind, mineral resources of every kind imaginable, many of which have not yet been imagined. God made them all, and he gave them to man for man to be his husbandman. Now, the fact that God owns all these things immediately places a restraint upon man. Man is not the owner. Man cannot do everything he wants, whenever he wants, in the way he wants. He should remember that God is the owner, and man is to use these material resources. Though in the words of the Creator, he was to subdue and have dominion and dress and keep. The idea behind all this was control. God controls. God controls man. Man must control. Discipline, restraint, economy for the blessing of every being, divine, human, and less than human, that has been created on this planet. Part number two. The world may be considered as people. God placed on man people, Adam and Eve. They could think, they could do, they could decide, they could get to know God. But the world knew him not. That speaks of Christ in particular, but it also speaks of God in general. Eve did not know, in the special sense of refusing to know, what God had said when he declared, you must not do certain things. So Eve refused to acknowledge God's authority. Adam defied God, deliberately went in the simplest of things, and when he had the whole world covered with a banquet of good things, chose to eat from the one tree of which God said, you must not eat of it. And yet, although it revolted, God loved, God gave, and God saved. God does in spite of what man has done. Part number 4. But while the world became evil, God didn't give it up. The whole world lies in wickedness. You can look at every system that the world has, animate, inanimate, and you can witness disintegration, disillusion, rebellion, hatred, kill and eat, destruction. Man is destroying the resources of the earth that are below its surface. Man is cutting down ruthlessly trees and reducing this planet to a desert. I wanted to see the vast cedars of Lebanon crowding the mountains of Lebanon, and went to a state park, and while I was eating my sandwiches, counted 182 surviving trees. They are being planted now here and there, and there are a few in some valleys. But man has destroyed the great forests people of those mountains. The same thing is taking place in many other parts of the world. The whole world lies in wickedness. As a result, there are wars, fightings, revolutions, murders, rapes, robberies, hostilities. What have we got to do? Well, God has given us example. We should regard the world. We should esteem the value of the world as God does. And God so estimates the treasure of the world that he bought it back from rebels at the price of the death of his Son. Part number 5. Christ reconciled the world to God. This was Christ's attitude to the world. God loved the world, and he gave. Christ loved the world and reconciled it unto himself, not imputing trespass unto it. And he has committed this word and work of reconciliation to his church. Because God loved the world, because Christ loved the world, because Christ reconciled the world to himself, the deity made a way by which he condemned sin and saved the penitent. He condemned sin, there's the justice, and he saved the penitent, there is the mercy. So God in Christ are exercising before the universe, before us, a ministry of reconciliation by which God can remain just, but at the same time be the justifier of all those who come to him. Now what have we got to do about this? This is part 6. We are to be in the world, but not of the world. This means that we are not to partake of those attitudes toward God that make the world worldly. We speak of worldly mindedness. Or we must not be worldly minded. We talk about the princes of this world having lordship, arrogant power, rulership, dominance. We are to be in the world, but not partake of its philosophies and its way of life. In fact, God wishes us to be renewed. The word that is used by Paul in Romans 12, 1 and 2, is to go through a process of metamorphosis from the egg to the worm to the chrysalis to the butterfly. This is a metamorphosis. And God has set in operation the powers of grace by which worldly-minded people might become heavenly-minded people. And so the whole plan of salvation is to bring about a metamorphosis. Jeremiah talks about Israel being a worm. God wishes that worm to become a butterfly with stardust on its wings, totally unrecognized, unrecognizable in a worm, but seen by God as being the ultimate potential of wormhood. We therefore should submit to the providences of God while we are in the world, refusing to be partakers of the world, of accepting the divine power and grace and eternal spirit, that we should be changed into His likeness from glory to glory. This will be the general theme of our studies, the relationship of the church as a corporate body and as individuals to the world.